Welcome back to another week of Wisecracks. This is going to be a good one, Bill. You are really delivering this month, Bill.
Yeah, John. No, we had some really good guests on, and I'm happy to have our guest in studio today, a friend of mine, George Martorano, and appreciate him coming on. Some of you guys may have heard him. George did 32 years in jail. That's right, 32 years.
Plus years.
A non-violent first-time offender. 32 years.
That's insane.
So it's insane. How about 5 years in solitary?
Wait, 5 years. What?
Yeah. Let's bring in George. George, thank you for coming on. Am I saying that right? Yes. 32 plus years, 5 years solitary confinement. And maybe you want to start out by, you were from South Philly.
Thank you guys from Wisecracks to have me on, John and Billy. I was a nonviolent first offender. I did 32 plus years, 5 years in we call it the box. I was the fourth person in America to ever get that sentence. The three before me were repeated violent offenders, drug dealers. One was the infamous Nicky Barnes, wound up being an informant. And then there was Herbie Sperling, a dear friend of mine. Herbie was a repeat offender. And actually, Herbie, when he was a young kid, I think he was 18, he used to drive the infamous Lepke from Murder Incorporated.
Sure, Louis Lepke.
And one was Felix, black guy out of L.A., big drug dealer. And then I come over. Actually, life no parole was CCE, continual criminal enterprise. And that's what carries the sentence, life no parole. But it actually was designed under the Nixon administration, but they didn't use it. They thought it was too harsh. And then when the drug war was implemented harshly in America, just targeted at the minorities, and that's when they start using it. But on my course of incarceration, 32 plus years, I only met two other guys that had it, and they were friends of mine. They were marijuana smugglers. They were whales, and they had life no parole. But life, ladies and gentlemen, you listeners out there, understand one thing. When you have life no parole, it means you come home in a body bag. Mm. That is it. And they did some very evil things to me when I got the life no parole. I was sent, never been in prison, never even had a parking ticket. I was sent to the worst prison known to man, and that was Marion, Illinois. And actually, it was 370 guys, or the worst prisoners, but most of them were, a lot of them, maybe half the prison, were from states that didn't have maximum security prisons. And these were guys like Mountain Men out of Montana, Wyoming, major drug dealers out of small states like New Hampshire and Connecticut. So in order for them to go to Marion, the governor of that particular state had to negotiate, used to pay, have these prisoners kept at Marion. So I'm at Marion with these 370 guys, and I had more time than the whole prison. And you start making some friends, the friends I made were serious friends, like Barry Mills and T.D. Bingham. They were head of the Aryan Brotherhood. They had ordered killings over 40 guys over the years. Mexican Mafia, Black Bob, and the guerrilla movement on the D.C. So I wind up with all these guys that I had more time than them. And I try to explain legally, because I'm really good. I got really good under necessity with federal law. And they couldn't grasp it. So I figured I'll fix this. Because you get tired of going over and over. I found a guy who had the biggest mouth in the cell block. And I said, come on, go for a walk. And I says, you know why I got life, no parole? And he says, why? I said, I was a hitman for the CIA. Oh, I knew it. I knew it. And by the next day, it was all around the prison.
Right.
We knew it.
Right.
We knew it. So that's what their mentality accepted. So
sure.
But I was in with the worst of the worst. One of them was, I don't think it was his real name. It was Daryl Holmes out of Colorado system. Daryl Holmes, any person working for the psychology department in federal prison has to read his file. The reason they have to read Daryl Holmes' file, incidentally, he was my workout buddy. Daryl Holmes cut three people's heads off in the Colorado system. He cut an inmate's head off. He cut a guard's head off. And what made him so infamous with psychology in America is he cut off a psychologist's head that was like very decorated psychologist in the state of Colorado, personal friend of the governor. And after Daryl cut the guard's head off, they made a movie, Runaway Train, ladies and gentlemen, with John Voight, and Eric Roberts, and they had him actually welded in a cell.
Wow.
That's a true story.
As far as they didn't kill him.
Daryl Holmes was welded in his cell.
Crazy.
In Colorado. And that's where the story came from. Jeez. And he put in a motion that he was treated worse than an animal. And the courts ordered him either into population or we're going to release him. Naturally, they weren't going to release him. So the governor gets on the phone, sends him to Marion. And Marion, the cell blocks, there's only 34 guys on a block. 17 on the flats, 17 upstairs. And when they wreck, they give you... You're only allowed out of your cell 11 hours a week, voluntary, not mandatory. You get an hour a day to get a shower or something and a little workout on the flats, and then you get allowed 2 hours gym a week voluntarily and 2 hours in the yard a week. So when they crack the cells on the cell block, it's only five at a time. And this so happens when the cell would crack, me and Daryl got to know each other, and we were workout buddies. and one day, the warden made his round on my cell block on Fridays. And, you can hear, there's bars, you can hear. So Daryl tells the warden, listen, warden, I've been here 3 years, and I had done program. I didn't cause you any trouble. But if I'm not out of here in 2 weeks, the head's coming off.
Oh, my God.
He told the warden,
this is your workout,
off.
Buddy.
He said, now you can come in the cell. You can toss it from top to bottom. You can run me to have an x-ray machine. When you come in the jail, they actually x-ray your body, see if you're hiding anything in your crevices of your body. And he said, you can run me through the x-ray. You're not going to find the knife. But in 2 weeks, the head's coming off.
Wow.
Warden's listening to him, right? So now... And they never tell you what time they're going to crack the cells. So I used to keep my workout stuff right at the bar. So a lot of times I used to walk right out of there with my underwear on the chair and then get dressed, put your sneakers and your sweats. So that particular day, he just told the warden he's cutting the head off. And I come out with a towel around my neck, right? And it's the first time I known him. I was working out him for a long time. I heard him laugh. He really laughed. It made me thought, well, this guy's human. Cause
he laughs.
He laughs, and he says, George, you're the only friend I got. He said, I could tell you, your head's not coming off.
Oh, good.
Wow.
But you see, I worked out with him every day.
Yeah.
Not today.
So the rest of the guys must have been, the other guys are in fear of you probably. Because they say, well, that's his workout, buddy.
You're absolutely right. You hit that right on the head. Jesus. A lot of my guys, and these were shot callers, big. We don't mess with that guy. Because the guy was about 5'11". Good-looking guy. He looked like the actor Peter O'Toole. And he studied martial arts, self-taught. I mean, he's just... But he was Daryl Holmes. You know, when you cut three people's heads off, you're never
on the inside.
Home.
Not even guys home. On the outside.
Well, yeah. He told me how he evolved into that. He was a kid on the streets, homeless in Seattle. And it was an arcade that he used to hang with, and a guy beat him up, much older guy, and he didn't know what to do. So he walked the streets, and he seen a beat cop, and he snuck up behind a beat cop and hit him with a brick just to take the gun. took the cop's gun, went back to the arcade, killed the guy, and peed on him.
Wow.
And that's how he wound up an assistant, and he became a legend.
Did they kill him in the end, George?
You know, when he, well, let me get back to his story. Now, the warden never comes in on a prison on a weekend unless it's absolutely necessary. So the warden came in Saturday morning. You know, Dale told him this on a Friday. Came in with his leisure clothes. I mean, he never gets close to the bar. He always keeps a good 4 or 5 feet away. And he says, Dale, no, he said, Holmes, I was on the phone with the governor of Colorado. I will have you out of here in 2 weeks. What they do with you is their business, but please, please don't do anything here. Dale just said one word, okay. And 2 weeks he was gone. Never, oh, wow. never. So, well, that's the kind of prison Marion was. I mean, the worst of the worst. But, you know, it was my first jail. But funny, you know, God must have looked out for me in the mysterious ways, because when I finally leave there, all these shot callers, I mean powerful shot callers, they sent word out, he's with us. And maybe my Italian buddies, the mob guys, first real jail I hit was Leavenworth. They couldn't believe all this power I had. But I used it in the right way, not the wrong way.
Sure.
I didn't bring in drugs. I didn't extort anybody. I didn't bully anybody. But
and just to tell our listeners and viewers, you were never a made mob guy. You're,
thank God.
Thank God. Yeah, your dad, of course, was Long John.
I chiseled my way out of jail. And the last thing they said, the only reason we're going along with his release program, Obama played a part, is that he's not a member of the Cosa Nostra. Because if you're a member of the Cosa Nostra, you have to kill somebody. That is basically what I heard the rule. My father was a member. I had a lot of friends that are members, still friends with a few old-timers. I don't get involved with young guys on the street today.
Right. And your godfather was the
Angelo Bruno.
He was the boss
of Philly for Christ over 20 years. He was assassinated in 1980, and it was a terrible time for us, because I think a lot of people agree today, a lot of lawyers, reporters, that our downfall, the Philadelphia downfall, my downfall included, was that Atlantic City. Atlantic City, everybody wanted a piece of the pie, and they wanted my godfather out of the way, because you couldn't get in. If you were from another mob organization, you ain't getting in Atlantic City. Even though Atlantic City was neutral, but the way it was set up many, many years ago, that my godfather inherited that you had to go through him. If you wanted to get some, say you guys were from Buffalo or Cleveland, you were mob guys or Tang guys, whatever, associates, you had to go through him, and they didn't want that. They didn't want that. So
I've never heard that before. I've never heard Atlantic City was a downfall like that.
That was the downfall.
Because they wanted
really,
to get in. Everyone
really
wanted
knows
in.
That
the linens and damn, the concrete that, construction.
Damn Atlantic City brought all the wars. You know.
Wow. Let's go back to Marion, though, because you said Marion, and we haven't talked about this. The most famous prisoner there that we know of, anyway, of course, was John Gotti. Not only did you know him, you were with him.
I think I pretty much know John better than a lot of people, even his relatives, because we were in a cell over 2 years.
Together in the same cell?
Same cell, 1 year, 22-hour lockup.
Wow.
Now, you're in a cell 22 hours with a guy. First thing we did, shook hands and made a pat. You know, nothing comes out of the cell we don't want talked about. And we played an awful lot of gin. And he was a better player than me. And we played for push-ups. I think one time I owed him 55,000 push-ups.
Oh, my God.
And I had to pay every day.
Oh, my God.
I had to pay every day. I was unbelievable shape then. I was only in my 30s. And I bang out 50 at a time, you know. I never could pay them all, but... and also, John, people don't know, he loved solitaire. Loved to play solitaire. He read very educational books. He didn't read no fiction and things like that. He read very, very intense books. Didn't sleep much. He was a guy that he'd read to 2, 3 in the morning, sleep 3 hours, go to court. Then he'd come back, take a little nap. But we were very, very close. Some stuff. Oh, that's a funny story.
Wait. So he was your cellmate when he was on trial?
The first trial.
Oh, wow.
When he walked out. I'll tell you that day. He walked out in 87. So I had a job. Everybody, when we finally got the doors cracked after a year, I remember we were just in a cell playing cards, and all of a sudden, we was on the tier with the commission trial. Our tier had 8 cells, 16 inmates, and you had to be a mob. You couldn't come on our tier. You couldn't even walk up on our tier. And we used to leave the doors open. You know, everybody got along. And I got a job, and my job was to clean the visit. You know, it was the floor that guy said he committed suicide. What was his name? Guy last year with the girls on the island.
Epstein?
Epstein, yeah. You know, I want to real quickly, ladies and gentlemen, go to another direction. I lived on that floor for a long time. You had the ears up, back and forth. And when they want something moved, when they want a guy moved, sometimes they bring in a rat and they'll just lock him in a cell for a day or two, or they don't want us to see something. They have screens, these stick-on screens. Now, every steel door has a window about 3 inches by 16 inches, and they slap this screen, and you can't see out your cell. But till today, I've been waiting. No one has asked that question, were the screens put up that night? Because some of them screens are put up, you can hear what you want, but you ain't going to see nobody getting hung. And my personal opinion, them screens were put up.
Wow.
You're not going to see. So no one has ever asked those questions. Was those screens put up?
Wow.
Well, and getting back to getting back to John. So I get this job, a little job. I got friendly with the guard. And my birthday was coming up. He said, when's your birthday? And I did a good job for the guard. I said, next week. He said, I'm going to bring you a surprise. So what he does, he brings me a veal cutlet hoagie.
Wow.
Big one.
Jesus.
And John liked to eat. He had an appetite. He worked out, though. And I had told John, I said, on my birthday next week, we're getting a sandwich. It just so happens, I even forgot it was my birthday. I'm up on the top bunk. I'm having a nap. He just woke up from a nap, and he kicks the bunk. Yo, go get the sandwich. Oh, I said, I forgot. So I jump down. I get my work tool, mop, broom, because my job is to clean the visiting room. And sure enough, the guy had the guard had the sandwich. I could have got it back into the cell block, not any trouble. I could have hit it under the bucket. I just stuck it in my waist. I figured everything was cool, right? And I come out, and I had marched around to get against the wall. It was a lieutenant and two guards. I get against the wall. They pat me down. They find the sandwich.
Oh, God.
They says, all right. And they just leave. So I go back to the cell with John. I said, John, they ambushed me over there. I got a bad feeling. I said, I got a bad feeling about this. He said, what bad feeling? It wasn't a gun. It was a sandwich. And sure enough, we're in there talking. About 20 minutes later, here they come. Lock in. The captain and the goon squad. Oh, my God. Came right to our cell. Martirano stepped out. And they grabbed me, threw me up against the wall, handcuffed me, took me to the hole. And the next thing I know, I think 2 days later, I made the front page. No, it was the Rigby cartoon. It was a very big cartoon in New York. I think, I don't know, the New York Daily News or the New York Post. And it's got me running with this big sandwich and stripes and all the guards chasing me. I don't know how they made it.
Wow.
See, what we found out down the road, the lieutenant that okayed the guard to bring the sandwich, this lieutenant didn't like that guard.
Oh.
So he set the guard. The guard was told to go home, too.
Wow.
Well, John was a good man. He had him working in construction that week. Guy was a family man. They sent him on the investigation with no pay for bringing in contraband. It was a sandwich. So, what tortures they put me
through. Wow, that was a setup.
You understand, Giuliani is running the commission trial. Giuliani is putting a report, not once a day, twice a day, from lieutenants. From that, he wanted to know everything we were doing on that unit. He had all the mob bosses. So they throw me in a hole. They put me in the worst cell in the hole. It was winter. It was so cold.
Oh.
I used to sleep with two sweats and two blankets. 1 month goes by. 2 months go by. Almost 3 months. And John's warned with them. He said, anybody you try to put in that cell besides that kid, I'm killing them. Tell him like that. So he's going, I'm killing him. So they ain't putting nobody in the cell. Meanwhile, I'm freezing and getting the worst end out of it. And a couple cops that I knew, I said, just get me a hearing. Give me a hearing. A hearing is if you do something wrong, they give you a hearing, and you either they'll credit you to your whole time or they'll give you a little more whole time. At least it's over.
Right.
But I couldn't even get a hearing.
And the hole, can you explain to the viewers and listeners, what is the hole? Is the hole? Well,
that hole in MCC New York is, but people don't understand there's a prison within a prison, and that is the hole. It's segregation. It's solitary. And that's where they had me.
For 5 years?
That was at other jails.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Five solitary for 5 years.
Like 5 years straight in the
five
other one?
5 years straight.
Wow. That's crazy. 5 years,
and explain also, good idea, John. What is solitary? We heard of it.
You're in an 8x10 cell. Is it?
Is there a light? Is it dark? Is it?
Well, they try to. Literally, the only time I almost lost my mind. We'll get into that.
Okay.
They kept me in the dark, and I think it's the worst thing you can do is put somebody in a cell with no light. I mean, the only time I almost lost it. But anyway, let me finish with the sandwich.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that. So I finally get a hearing. And there was this big lieutenant, May. He was from, Brooklyn. All these cops are in these tiny neighborhoods. Everybody knows everybody, basically. And he says, now listen, Mark Toronto, you're getting a hearing today. Now he's got me cuffed walking into the hearing. He says, whatever you do, don't laugh. Don't you laugh. I don't know what I mean, but don't laugh. So I walk into the hearing. I'm cuffed behind my back. I couldn't believe what it was here. The warden, the associate warden, the captain, a U.S. attorney, the FBI.
Oh, my God.
And the reason he said, don't laugh, what was on the table? Give you a guess what was on the table.
Don't tell me the sandwich.
The sandwich frozen.
Evidence.
Frozen.
Exhibit A. Exhibit A.
Wow.
Because John was... He was the talk of New York. He was the talk of country. He was basically talk
of course.
London, Paris. So, they wanted me to talk on John. I ain't able to talk on John. So, and they says, we're gonna let you out of the hole today, but you're on indefinite probation or suspension. Indefinite. Oh, this is funny. Another one. I'm in the hole, languishing in the hole about this damn sandwich. And I hear the warden's voice. Sounds are very prevalent when you're doing solitary. You know how a cop walks. You know his keys. You hear keys. You know it's sounds very prevalent. So, excuse me. Let me get a drink.
Sure, go ahead.
Where was I at? Where was I at? Where was I at?
Sounds are very prevalent.
Yeah, sounds are very prevalent. So, I finally. We have this hearing. They take the cuffs off of me, go back to the cell. Guess what he says, John, as soon as I get.
Did you bring back the sandwich?
Where's the friggin' sandwich?
Oh, my God.
But he's Sonny teasing me. And we hugged and we kissed. And I looked around the cell because I'm cleaning.
OCD?
Yeah.
OCD.
Yeah.
John's okay, but he ain't like me. And he probably said, I can't keep it clean like you kept it.
So you actually do get to go back, though, in the same cell, because John threatened him, don't put anyone in the cell or I'll kill him.
Yeah. And we just lived together, and excuse me, I'm just getting over.
No, you're fine, fine. That's interesting to have that kind of power in there, like John, right? Like.
Yeah, he said, I'm going to kill someone if he puts
anyone. He has nothing to lose at that point, right? He's in there for...
They weren't letting him out.
Right.
No, he's in there for life. But then again, George got a life sentence too, which we'll get into. So right. George is going to be away for life.
Right.
You know.
More time than John.
Yeah, more time. Yeah, think about that.
So anyway,
for selling marijuana, he had more time than John.
That has to be maddening today, knowing that things are legal.
So let's get back to
John. All right, go ahead. Sorry.
The world loves John.
Sure.
We need a 10-hour podcast with you.
Right.
So it's his trial. His jury has been out for a while. It is... Excuse me, ladies.
No, no problem.
You're okay.
Yeah. I have that dry cough. Anyway.
It's Vegas.
Yeah.
It's Friday the 13th. The jury has been out, and it's the beginning of a long weekend, three-day weekend. So he's cursing. Every morning he got up, he wanted the same thing. Cranberry juice, fresh lemon. We used to get lemons from the commissary, and his vitamins. With a cup of black coffee. That was standard every morning. And the door's open and he's cursing. It's Friday the 13th. John was very superstitious. It's Friday the 13th. I know they're going to come in guilty. I said, nah, take it. Fuck you. And we had an Italian guy there, Tony, what was his name? Forget. He was from Sicily. He had a drug case. And he comes to the door and he says, John, don't worry, it's okay. In Sicily, Friday the 13th is a lucky day. John said, remember like Ralph Crandon? Get out!
Right, get out.
Get out!
We love the honeymooners.
So every morning I used to walk him to the elevator. Got to crack the cell block door, and there's a bell. I walk him to the elevator. Elevator come up. I'm going to go down, I ring the bell. Anyway, we're near... waiting, and he's still cursing. Soon as the elevator door opened, he grabbed me from the back of the head, and he pulls me to his mouth, in my ear, call me tonight. What do you mean, call him tonight? He knew he was going home. And he was cursing. I said, this guy should be in Hollywood. He knew he was going to be home tonight.
Wow.
And, I guess what? He got out that night.
He was home that night?
Friday the 13th.
Wow. Isn't that something?
He said, call me tonight at home.
Going back to the beginning, because we kind of skipped around. Why? How can it be possible, a marijuana case? By the way, you weren't physically busted with any marijuana,
never,
correct?
It's conspiracy.
Conspiracy. Imagine this. He wasn't physically busted.
Well, they had more conspiracies on me than you can think of. LSD, heroin, but that
conspiracies.
Was all guys wired up saying things. But the only real case they had was the marijuana with the FBI.
And so tell everyone why you got this kind of sentence, because of your lawyer, the judge.
You got to understand.
And your father, of course.
Philadelphia, after my godfather was killed, there was a lot of bodies getting dropped from Newark down to Philly. And then you had the next second war. With Philip, I mean, there was bodies getting dropped. And then you had the third war with Harry. That was before the other wars happened when I was in prison. No arrests. I think over 60 or 80 guys killed. Nobody was arrested.
For all those killings.
And then me, a young knucklehead with marijuana. Nine of us got arrested. Everybody didn't rat. They were all my friends I grew up with. And there was no mob guy in there. There was no mob guy, so... what my prosecutor did that, I don't know, they're supposed to have integrity, but I don't believe he has integrity. He just was an evil man. He wanted to be another Giuliano, you know, go on to become
make a name for himself,
mayor.
Sure.
What he did, well, it's not going to mention his name, but what he did, this dog, he went to Washington. This is what I heard from an attorney. He went in front of a Senate subcommittee or congressional subcommittee, either or, I forget, and went into the room in front of them and said, I will bring down the Nikki Scarfo mob through Mark Toronto's indictment. When they heard that, you know, they've been trying to get Nikki for years. They gave him $3 more million. And they gave him target. They superseded my indictment to target. You know what target indictment means?
No.
I don't think there's only two or three people in America ever had a target indictment. I forget the other two were. Target means on your indictment, on the top of your indictment in capital letters says target. And right under the usually when you any kind of legal document has to be signed on the last page, not a target indictment. Right under there is a line signed by the United States attorney, U.S. attorney. I think it was French. So when they heard that he was going to bring down the Scarfo mob, they turned my indictment to a target, and a target indictment brings international powers. In other words, if I ratted, they would have grabbed my friends and Costa Rica, they would have grabbed my friends in Colombia, they would have grabbed my friends in Jamaica. So they may sign me target. But he didn't deliver because my indictment came down. No, nobody had a record.
Right.
One guy was a mailman, you know, so he got egg on his face, a lot of egg on his face, and his career wasn't going anywhere. So he wasn't involved in actually conspiracy. Was my judge, my lawyer, and that Nikki Scarfo. He pushed the conspiracy to get me life, no parole. How could Nikki figure that I wouldn't be a rat? I don't know. Because I had the worst sentence ever get to an Italian ever in America. But I, as long as my mother and my sister, my family could walk the streets with their head up, I couldn't care if they executed me. That's the way I am, but not today. And Joey, my friend Joey, he's been doing a lot of, he's like that, go to the grave as a man. Anyway.
You're referring to Joey Merlino?
Yeah, I know him since me and his dad were extremely close.
Chucky.
His dad was a gangster's gangster. One of the people taught me how to dress, one of the best dressers ever in Philly. Joey was much younger. And so getting back to the case, he didn't deliver. What he said, you know, you don't go in front of Washington, D.C. congressional or Senate subcommittee, say you're going to deliver and don't deliver. So he knew his career wasn't going anywhere. So after the double cross in the courtroom, I had to be, this prosecutor tortured me for years, all the worst prisons. I mean, this, and the wardens used to tell me, when I did the 5 years in a box, we call it the box, wardens used to tell me, Mark Toronto, I don't have you in solitary. It's that U.S. Attorney's Office in Philly. And what that dog did to me, I never forget, back then, if you had anything over 30 years and you were a pretrial facility, you had to go to the hole. But I had life, no parole. Lucky they didn't put me, and they did come prisons, put me in a basement cells, but it ain't nothing nice. Anyway, I'm chained in the marshal's car. two marshals are driving me to Marion from the airport somewhere. Marion's south central Illinois, and I think I flew into, forget what airport, St. Louis. Anyway, the marshals chain you up, and they were driving to Marion. It's night. And I never forget that night. It's vivid in my memory. I think the most prettiest thing I ever saw. We're driving on this road, just a little two-lane road, and I seen a barn on fire, ladies and gentlemen, a barn. And a beautiful white horse was just running around the barn, panicking. And to me, I would say, I hope there wasn't no other horses, because she was like this beautiful white horse. I don't know if he was a stallion. And then a short time later, after seeing this picturesque scene, we pull in front of Marion. Who's out front? A warden with his goon squad. And he goes right up to the marshals. So I'm refusing Martirano. Marshall says, what do you mean? He says, I'm refusing him. And this man never been in prison before. He's got him at the worst prison. I don't know what, how he felt through the cracks. I don't want him. It's 8:30 at night. These marshals want to go get a hotel. So I sit in the car, and the warden walks away with his goon squad. So one marshal goes in, one marshal stays in the car with me. I sat in that car a good hour, hour and a half, and sure enough, the warden comes back out with his marshal, the goon squad, with a piece of paper. He said, Martirano, I'm not going to show you, I'm not supposed to show you this paper, but I'm going to show you what that U.S. Attorney's office did in Philly. And he made me read it. They went, this dog, to get me into Marion. My security level was a 3. And the security levels back then went from 1 to 6. 1 being the lowest, 3, and then the worst is max. It's above a 6. The paper made me max security.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Because they went and found some rats and made rats say, one rat tell another rat that I had contracts on FBI agents. It never came out on trial. I was a nonviolent first offender. And the warden says, I have to take you now. I have to take you. He says, this is what they did to you. So I walked through that Marion. It took me some years to get out of there. So everybody knew I was from the warden said, word, they screwed this guy. Yeah, I'm on Christ Almighty. I'm only 30. 31, 32, just turned 33.
Wow.
And so I'm there doing the best I can. And I make him this unit manager took a like, he wound up being a warden somewhere, Joe Class or something like that. He comes to my cell, he says, listen, I'm sending you to Springfield, Illinois for a mental study. I said, why? He says, if they say you have never been in prison before, you're at the worst prison in America, probably the world. He said, if they show it, if you have any deterioration, I'll get you out of here. But I need to document it. We don't have that type of psychology department to do an in-depth study. So here I go. Worst thing I did was agree to that. So next week, load me up in a van. You put me in a van with a mountain man and a Mexican gang member. This guy was a mountain guy. And they give you a bag of bologna, you know. Guards will minister a bag of bologna or two on the way there. So we're driving, and this mountain guy, I think he killed a couple game wardens. He says, I heard about you. You're that guy, Italian. You're that Italian that they buried. I says, yeah, I'm the guy. He said, what do you want? I said, what do you want? He said, you want Kentucky Fried Chicken? You want McDonald's? I'm saying, well, this guy's nuts, you know? I says, yeah, I'll take Kentucky Fried Chicken. I went along with him. He says, okay, he got up. Stands, he braces himself against the van, and he starts rocking. He starts rocking. And he's rocking. The cops tell him, sit down. He says, I ain't sitting down. He's rocking. So enough, after 5-6 minutes of rocking, the wheels start going off the ground. That's how big this guy was. They panic. Guess what? We were eating Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Wow.
He's out step. So I said, man, I got a good guy to on this ride. Because
wow.
from Illinois to Missouri, we had to go. It's a good 8-9 hour drive. And we're riding along, and he says, how about some Arby's or, or McDonald's? I said, man, I ain't had a Whopper in a long time. He said, all right. So anyway,
wow.
We finally get to Springfield. This is a mountain guy. He killed people. They put him in population because he was going for some kind of medical exam. They put him in population. Me, They take me to it's called Doghouse, but I didn't know until I got it. It's the Criminally Insane Unit.
Jeez.
So I'm in Marion, the worst prison in America, and Marion was like a Hilton compared to this. It's called Dog Unit. And the first thing they do, they have they whatever you have on. You already had prison clothes. They strip you down, and they give you paper clothes. You ever see paper clothes?
Paper clothes?
Paper clothes. Paper T-shirt, paper underwear, paper slip-ons, okay, and a paper jumpsuit. The reason they give you paper, because the cells are different, criminal insane, they're very high ceilings. And they don't want you getting a blanket and hanging up, because if you got a paper blanket, it's not going to hold you right. I figure, okay, I'll ride with that. Now, they came in a cell, and I noticed right away there's a leg iron. To the bunk, it's the leg iron's about 4 foot, and they leg iron, I think it was my right leg or my left leg, where you can only reach the toilet and the food slot.
Wow.
So I got paper clothes.
Jesus.
I'm leg iron.
Talk about torture.
I wish you had a bag around here. You got a bag? Anybody got a bag? I want to tell you what it felt like when you rolled over. It was like wrinkling a bag.
Oh, right. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I'm in there. I said, oh, my God. So Fat Tony heard I was here. Fat Tony Salerno. He knew me since I was a little guy.
Fat Tony, the big boss, very wealthy.
For over 40 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, he sends a lieutenant late at night. He's, hey, Mark Toronto, they're going to do the Dr. Stark treatment. Stark, S-T-A-R-K. I said, what's that? Said, I don't know. But all I'm telling you is don't go off. When a lieutenant tells you don't go off, I said, what are they going to do, whip me? And sure enough, they gave me the Stark treatment, which is like they'll come one day in the middle of the night, they'll bring your meals for the day all frozen. Your lunch, your breakfast, lunch, and dinner frozen. They'll bring that. And then when you go to shower, they actually chain your ankles and your hands. And it's a cell shower. It's a little cell. And they put you in a shower on the cold water. Kept me on the cold water one time for almost 3 hours. 3 hours. We're chained up. They're trying to get you to go off.
Right.
But I always been warned. All I did was smile, right? And one day they take me to the yard. And it was summertime. It was August. Left me out in that yard with no water for hours and hours and hours. So I put up with it. I put up with it, the Stark treatment.
Wow, just trying to break you.
Well, they wanted to see if I was violent.
Oh, right, right.
That's what they wanted to see. So, and I stood there the summer of 1985. When I finally got back to Marion, it felt like I made bail.
And that's the worst prison in America, but that's what it felt like.
And when we leave, the mountain guy goes back. I don't know what kind of procedure they did. And I couldn't stop laughing. They opened up. When they had chainers in the van, they put in a cooler about 4 foot long, full of food, sandwiches, cakes, fruit, drinks. In other words, they didn't want him rocking the van anymore. So they just...
Right.
And that mountain man, he tried to eat everything before he got to Marion.
Jesus.
And but, oh, there's one time, they have inside cages on the criminally insane unit where you go, take you out of your cell. The cage is as big as a cell, and they had three cages. I wind up in the middle cage, and as soon as I hit it, and I'm working out, I was one of, you know, because you're chained all day. I'm loosening up. I'm push-ups, headstands, burpees. I'm trying to loosen up. And all of a sudden, two more guys come. And I noticed this one guy, every time I went somewhere, he was going somewhere. I said, what's going on? And I catch on. There was a guy on one cage. He made guys are ingenious in prison. He made a zip gun from a radio antenna. And he's got this zip gun, and he's trying to shoot this other guy. And that's why the guy's following me. And I said, oh, no. And then I hit this guy that got the zip gun. Dive down, dive down. So I dived down. Bang, he shot caught the guy on the shoulder with a screw.
Oh.
I said, what kind of jail you am I at over here?
Jesus.
That was the criminal insane unit.
Wow.
And, ladies and gentlemen, don't ever think that it's a myth. When there's a full moon, crazy people go off. Well, let me tell you something. I lived in that cell block 2 months, and when that full moon came out each month, those two nights were like the mold asylums back in the 1700s.
Wow.
I mean, I couldn't believe that. But it is true when it is a full moon.
Wow.
And that
wow.
was, and then I go back to Marion, and there was something in the report. I don't forget what it was. They said, all right, Martin around, give us a little more time. We're going to send you to out of here to a penitentiary. You can't leave Marion unless you go to honor block. You got to go to the honor block, and then from the honor block, you got to go to a penitentiary. Back then, there was probably five in the country. Lewisburg, Atlanta, Leavenworth, Lompoc, and Terre Haute. So you go to one of them. I wind up in Leavenworth. And that's when I really start seeing what I did my 5 years already in lockdown. It was when I really started jailing. And talk about being in dark, in the dark. Just before I got to Marion in 84, November in 84, they had just killed two guards. I mean, they guy name of two guys, last name of Fountain, and the other guy was Silverstein. I think they made a movie somewhere with Steve Silverstein. Anyway, they killed two guards. So now, if you had Marion on your jacket where you're housed, every jail around the country, you were an animal to them.
Mm-hmm.
You kill guards there. I didn't kill any guards, but I was a Marion prisoner. So I wind up in transit. I had to go back on writ for something. I had to take the fifth to help a co-defendant. But I'm in the hole everywhere I went. They take me to this, I think it was Clare County, East Clare, East some jail. And they're taking me, and I'm going down this hall. Next thing I know, they're taking me to the basement. And I'm smelling, it's musty. And they take me to an illegal cell. They're illegal. They're called boxcar cells. They're all steel, no window, and there's two steel doors. Two steel doors, not one, two. And you have a food slot on the bottom of each door. The doors are about 3 feet apart. And they actually get a pole. They put the food on the floor and they slide it through the two. They feed you like you're an animal.
How big of a space is it? Is it like this?
No, they're small. Boxcar cells, they're about 5 by 7.5. So I'm in there and I had one light bulb on a wire, and you had a string. I was there 2-3 days, and the light bulb went out. I'm in total darkness. The only light I'd ever seen was a little bit when they slide the food. But every time I'm saying, listen, I need a light bulb.
That'll drive you insane.
Yeah.
No and light.
Yeah.
Their answer was, F you, you're Marion prisoner, you guard killer.
Oh.
I didn't kill no guard.
Right. Now, they know exactly what you've done, though, also, right? Like, they know you're not even a guard
when
killer.
When you go anywhere, it's called a traveling jacket. You don't... A prisoner's full jacket over the years, you could start with 1 inch. The time I did 32 plus years, because they always add to your jacket, my jacket was 12 inches high. But you always have a traveling jacket, and it tells a little bit about it. But it didn't say, no, I'm a killer, or I wasn't at Marion when the guards, but they, you know, guard mentality, you know. I mean,
guilty by association, right?
Wrong mentality. Some guards is okay, you know. And, they wouldn't give me a light bulb. I screamed for a light bulb. I cried for. I almost lost my mind.
Just for.
Do you have any concept of time when you're in there like that? You don't, right? That's what drives you nuts, right?
What saved me from really, and it takes a lot to get to me, an awful lot. I was bending down for the tray, and the light. I caught a little sliver of light under the bunk there, and it was a pencil, a little pencil, and. And I got that pencil, and I start writing on the floor. I didn't see what I was writing, but you have mind-hand contact.
Sure.
I start writing cursing words, and I started writing poetries. And I start writing short stories on the walls. I try to save my brain, you know, going crazy. And then I finally, finally got out of there. It's a couple weeks, and you know, you come out of the, you're blinded, and I got, I'm cuffed behind my back, but I can't see. I've got my, and I hear one guard. That son of a bitch wrote all over the cell. But that's how writer, you know. Then I went on to write novels and.
How'd you sharpen a pencil? May I ask?
Teeth.
Oh, your teeth. I was just wondering.
Yeah, it was a level. There's different levels
of lead.
Oh, so you
gotta taste the lead.
In prison, they get that real hard lead, and I, with my teeth.
So you wrote all over the walls, the whole prison.
That's how I became a writer.
Wow.
How many words did you wind up writing in life, they said?
Oh, I had just had all my stuff put on the hard drive. It's over 2 million words.
2 million words, wow.
I wrote freehand. I had, over the years, I got carpal tunnel twice.
Right.
From elbow to wrist from writing so much. And you get that, it's like having a toothache. You can't sleep at night. I must publish twice. And then I went in, when e-books came out, electric books, I did well with them. On ebook, and then I think it was, I'm revising it now. It's called Mob King Pen, PN. I was the first prisoner in the world to create his own website where you pay with PayPal, download PayPal. First prisoner in the world, and all I was writing fiction stories. Well, the Bureau of Prisons didn't like that, and they came in the middle of the night, chained me up and shipped me to another jail. But I didn't take down the website, Mob King Pen. You know, making some money, help my kids. Second jail, they really brutalized me. Threw me on the floor, gave me a beating. One cop, I'll never forget, my face was pressed against the floor, and I seen him pull out a knife out of his boot, and he put it to my right wrist. He said, oh, I ought to cut your handle. This is the mentality I was dealing with. I was just writing. So I finally, a friend of mine, a lawyer out of Baltimore, went physically to the Bureau of Prison, told the story what they're doing to this man for his writing, and then it stopped after that. It was Mob King Pen. So I established myself as a writer and a mentor educator.
And then she went on to teach and stuff. And what, were you denied? I read you were denied a Pell Grant.
Oh, yeah.
From Congress.
After I got my GED, it was a congressman named Zimmerman. What an idiot. He put in a bill to take away the Pell Grants, and in the bill also was take away all the weights. Prison guards didn't want any prisoners. They said they were getting too strong. And so now if a guy gets his GED, or a woman in prison gets her GED, we used to have colleges all around the country, community college. Every federal prison had attached to a community college, and these professors, after you got your GED, they would come in and teach you whatever you wanted to be taught. They take away the Pell Grant. So how do you tell a guy that can't use his brain anymore? They had distant learning programs, but an inmate can't afford no $800-$900 course. Can't afford no $800-$900 course. So I had a sympathetic warden. I said, this is not right. And me and him figured it out what to do, and I can honestly take credit. I brought reentry program to America. Reentry program is in every federal prison and every state program. What reentry program in the Bureau of Prisons was labeled skills program, S-K-I-L-L-S. And the skills program was very stringent. You actually had to sign an agreement with the directors of the program. It was 18 months. And in that 18 months, you learn other classes to prepare you for society. And I was a major factor. Two of my classes are still going on. Very proud of that. It's called Fathers Behind Bars. We took estranged fathers and united them with their children through a process. And then we also had the how to start a business for $1,000 or less. You can do 20 years in prison. The day you release, you're lucky if you get $50.
Sure.
And that's the way it is. And it's still today, ladies and gentlemen, prison is no, it's still mandatory minimum. You got to do 85% of your time. Wow. 85.
And Washington, D.C. actually approved, am I correct for you, to have your own curriculum?
Yes, because
Washington, D.C. Yes. And you actually, we haven't talked about this, so we're going to say it now. Did you, I'm reading right here, you graduated 8,000 students that you personally taught.
I was up to 400, graduating 400 students every season of the year.
Wow.
Wow.
8,000 students.
Seven classes.
Is that what helped to get your release?
Was part of it, Ralph. When I finally got... I went through three judges before I came home. My last judge, I established the case in the Second Circuit. I established the case in the Second Circuit. I'm in the Third Circuit because I figure I ain't going to get nothing. But I took a kid, violent case. Been in jail twice as a carjacker. That's violent. And he had Judge Gleason. Judge Gleason was the judge that he was a prosecutor that prosecuted John on the second RICO, went on to be a judge, went on to be appeals court judge. Now he's retired. He just wrote a book last year, Judge Gleason. So this guy John that was helping me in the classroom, you know, write, cleaning the blackboard, raking copies. Guy's been helping me for a couple of years now, and he had just lost a second 2255, and he was crying. I'm in 22 years, and my mother's sick. You got to get me home. You got to get me home. I said, what am I going to do? Anyway, I wrote a letter. I'm really good at writing condensed words. In other words, you don't write 10 pages. I wrote a beautiful one-page letter, basically telling the story, my relationship and his conduct at the prison, but also attached to the letter his progress report, because in prison, whether you're in state or feds, ladies and gentlemen, every 6 months you get a progress report. And that tells you if you stabbed the guy, you're selling drugs, or you've been doing good. You've been graduating classes. So I attached his progress report, send the letter. I figured he ain't never going to hear from this judge. This was Judge Gleason. About 4 weeks later, 5 weeks later, he come running in the classroom with a piece of paper. What is this? What is this from the court? I look. He got a docket number. You cannot get into court unless the judge accepts your case, his clerk notifies the clerk of the court, and you get a docket number. And that's how you enter your appeals, your motions. Got to have a docket number. He had a docket number. I couldn't believe it. So, make a long story short, I get him out. I had to prepare a motion. It was just two-prong, you languishing in prison and good prison record, good conduct. That was all. And he gets let out. But the U.S. attorney in Philly would not recognize it to be published. It was unpublished under seal because...
This kid's life. Yeah. You got him out.
Well, I walked him to R&D. You don't leave a jail unless you go through R&D. And I told him, I said, John, if I hear you come back to jail, I don't care if it's state or fed, you better go in the hole, under the hole.
Right.
Because,
of all you did for him,
Don't come back.
Yeah.
So now, about 2 months go by, I'm laying on my bunk. I wanted that time. I said, all right, the story you just heard, how I got this out, I just wrote a one-page letter and told the judge. Wrote the letter, had it on my desk in a cell, little tin desk. It was there for over a week. It's got coffee stains on it, Finally, a buddy of mine says, that letter's in Sender. Why don't you mail that letter? I said, I ain't going nowhere. I tell you what, he lived on the flats.
Downstairs.
In the cell near the mailbox. I said, yeah, here's his stamp. Put it in the mailbox. So, time goes by. I don't know where I was in the yard or one of my classes. Prisons run by loudspeakers for visits, medical. I just march around, report to the warden's office. So there, in any prison, the warden's office is not in the prison. They're always on the outside. But when they say report to, it's always the AW, assistant warden's office. So I go there, and the warden says, your lawyer's been calling here. When's the last time you talked to the lawyers? I said, I don't know. A few weeks, he says, your lawyer's been calling here. He said, here's the phone. Pushed me the phone. I called my lawyer. What's up? You got a docket number. You got an in chambers hearing. You got a docket number. I says, you know why I got a docket number? Because 4 years ago, when I knew I was going to lose that appeal, what did I tell you, three lawyers, biggest lawyer in the country? I told you not withdraw. If I lose, don't withdraw from the case. Stay on the case as attorney of record. And I had gave him the last bit of money I had in my life, $380,000 check.
Wow.
That was my future. I gave him the money. I said, oh, we're going to win. I said, yeah, I've been hearing that for a long time. I says, do not withdraw attorney records. So the judge, first thing she did is told the clerk, does he have attorney of record? They said, yes, he still has three attorneys on record. Because if I don't have attorney record, now the decision, it becomes broader to the judge. Not only she has to give me a docket number, she has to appoint an attorney, which brings it to a different decision. Judges don't want to get into that.
Interesting.
So that's how I wind. So right away, I started preparing my prison dossier.
Wow.
Professionally prepared. I had the whole legal department working with me. We did this beautiful, all my accomplishments. I sent her my pile of the Writers Guild in L.A. from when I registered all my writings. And on the phone, listening, because I showed the judge respect. I says, you don't have to take me up there. You don't have to take me up there for this. Because I said, let me make this judge as comfortable with me as she can, judge. And when she reviewed my prison dossier, they said she took a lot of time. And when she finally, I had three attorneys in that judge's chambers. And she turned around, she says, I never seen nothing like this. This is extraordinary. And that's how we prepared a motion, and she told the prosecutors were giving me a hard time. They said, nobody wants to keep, I'm in over 30 years now. Nobody wants to keep Mark Toronto in anymore. But all this, you know, I was in articles while I was in prison. I made myself known to the world by writing letters. I had one town in France. I used to write short stories. I think it was Gouverneur or something like that. They used to convert it to French and post it all over town.
Wow.
So I had a whole town as fans. Anyway,
wow.
I made myself known to the world from writing. And
is she the one that actually let you out or had the influence to let you out?
So this was, we had the in-chambers hearing. 10 months go by before I walked out, but in the course of that 10 months, she was sending messages to the prosecutor. Listen,
right.
I will release him on the Holloway case,
wow.
which they didn't want. They told the judge he's too popular. So in other words, all the good that I did actually worked against me.
Yeah.
They said he's too well known. It'll be a floodgate. None of the circuits, every federal prisoner who's been sitting there, but got an old guy just sitting there for years, he didn't cause no trouble.
Right.
So they said it's going to be a floodgate around the country. So all I good were actually worked against me.
Wow.
So how are you going to win?
8,000 students.
How do you win? What am I going to do? Have escape attempts, stab people?
Right.
So I sat 10 months and my lawyer gets a call, and within those 10 months, report to the U.S. Attorney's Office. So he walks into the U.S. Attorney's Office. And my lawyer's an international lawyer. He's the one that got Amanda Knox out of Italy, beat that case.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, George, I walked in here, my mouth agape. Like, he said, I couldn't believe he was sitting there. You had my U.S. attorney, of course, her boss, of course, his boss from Washington, D.C., the head, I think it was a black woman named Leach, her, the head of the DEA, the head of the FBI. He said he couldn't believe it. He said, "What is this?" Well, we decided we're gonna let Marcherano out. Well, nobody wants to sign. My lawyer said, "What do you mean?" My prosecutor said, "I'm not signing. I want more signatures to join mine." And again, my lawyer said, "This man is over three decades. No one has a prison record." They said, "No, he's too popular now." My lawyer said, doesn't make sense. We didn't want to try to escape every year. Then you're going to let him out. So it was like a catch 22. She didn't want to present the release until she wanted other signatures. I don't find out why until when I finally get out. So I don't know what to do. And I knew this lieutenant for 20 years. I think it was my third prison with him. Good guy. And he finally, in prison, staff, guards, and staff, they get 90 days at a station. You do 90 days. So he got what you call morning watch. Head lieutenant morning watch, that's from 12 to 8. So he had complete autonomy over the prison. He could have let me out. He's actually had warden status. So he would come in about 4 in the morning. No, he would come in at 12, 4 in the morning. He always, and me and him would sit there trying to figure out. I don't know what they want from me. So we're figuring out. I says, I got to do something drastic. So there was two gangs ready to go off. It's coming. It was a Puerto Rican gang and a Mexican gang. They're going to go off. And every morning I used to go to yard early before my classes, and I just had one aluminum steel benches, bleachers. I used to work out off of, you know. And I noticed chunks is missing out of it. And these inmates are ingenious. They know how to cut metal. They make a diamond string. And right away I knew somebody's making knives. I found out who the knife maker was. He was a junkie. Now, junkies got to pay their bill. Either they make knives or they make moonshine, wine. They got to pay their dope bill. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm selling the knives. I said, to who? What gang? Both of them. I said, both of them. When they find out, you're going to get killed. I said, I'm going to save your life because you're an idiot. I said, how many knives you got? He said, I got a lot. I says, I'll buy them all. Give me a price. So give me an address. I'll send the money. Gave me a price. I think I bought them all for like $40 a piece. I think there was like 80 knives. Anyway, so the lieutenant, I hid them in the yard. The lieutenant called me up that night. I said, come on, we're going to the yard. And I showed him the knives. But I didn't give the name. I ain't giving no name to nobody.
Sure.
He said, this is gold. So he goes and write up this amazing report. One for Marcherano. I had dead guards and bodies all over. Because they did go off.
Right.
They did go off the very next day. They were hitting each other with locks and socks.
Sure.
I mean, they were.
But it wasn't
bad.
Knives.
But no,
right.
No killings.
Right.
No killing. Maybe a couple of razors.
Yeah.
They went off bad. And now I'm locked in, but he's coming to my cell and says, your lawyer went crazy over this. It's what them son of a bitches wanted to see. Even though I did all this greatness over the years, they wanted to see if I really want to help them, like, in a certain way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not, like I said, I didn't give no name who made the knives. And when they finally got that report, They all signed, and I was out of jail in 2 weeks.
Wow. What was it like to taste freedom when you went out?
Let me finish. Okay. Let me finish. And I go to probation office with my lawyer in Philly. I did my acclimation of freedom in St. Pete, Florida for 90 days. You know, I didn't sleep inside for 3 months. Slept in a tent. I couldn't sleep inside. I developed
claustrophobia?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be, had the tent flap open. I looked up at the stars.
Wow.
And I couldn't sleep inside. Anyway, long story short, I tend to stay in Florida. My mother got ill. She was living alone. Matt's son, she took care of me for 32 plus years. I immediately transferred to Philly. So when you transfer on your own parole, probation, whatever, you got 24 hours. The report. So I fly into Philly. I get my lawyer. The next day, I'm in the probation office. I got a suit and tie. And I hadn't smoked weed just yet. But I'm dying. I'm really wanting to smoke. So I go in. Florida really treated me good. But I figured Philly, you know, they're going to be a little rough. So we walk in the probation office, and it was a woman. She ran the department, but that wasn't my parole officer. She said, sit down, Mr. Martirano. My lawyer sits down. I don't sit down. I got a joint in my pocket, a big, nice joint, a sativa with a lighter, right? And I put my, I said, "You, if you're going to urinalyze me," I put my hands up. I said, cuff me, take me back. She looked at me. She says, I said, yeah, I don't want to say piss test.
Sure.
Take me back. She gets up. Okay, she gets nervous, walks out. My lawyer says, I never knew how crazy you was till today. She comes back. Not 5 minutes later, she says, no, you're an Alice.
Wow.
And that's when I sat down. So we get done that, and then we're walking out of the federal building, same place where you go to federal court. And I says, come on, Walt. I'll get you lunch. He says, no, I got a surprise for you. And we walking. I didn't know he was taking me to the U.S. Attorney's offices, federal U.S. Attorney's offices in Philly. It's the same thing when you go in the courthouse. It's got metal. You got to go take off your belt, like, you know, the airport, all the metal. So we go there. We get off the elevator, and there's security there, and as soon as you get off the elevator, there's this long hall. And we're walking down this hall, and they're all coming out. Secretaries and prosecutors all shaking my hand. I said, geez, this is never been done before, a guy like me. Just like my speech at Wharton School. From my background, never been done before. Anyway, they take me in a conference room. Who's in the conference room is the U.S. attorney that she's been fighting me for 7 years. Her boss. And my lawyer, we sit down, and the story she told me, I almost fell over. She said, Martirano, I want to tell you this, because no one has a prison record. And she's in one of my documentaries saying this. She said, no one has a prison record like you. She wants you to know, she told us, his FBI agent, he retired as FBI agent. That's why I got out. It was an FBI agent, I don't want to say his name, but he's going to be in my lawsuit. Was his job to make sure I died in jail.
Jesus.
Because my prosecutor had retired. They made a pat. Somebody, an informant, an Irish informant that was very close to my father. My father don't know he's an Irish informant until today. Told him, as soon as Georgie gets out of jail, he's going to kill you. I never threatened the guy. Never thought of killing him. But he was using him like that, giving him information and getting what he could from this U.S. attorney, giving him false information. Actually, Whitey Bulger taught him how to do that. Whitey Bulger. So, and she started crying. She said, I want you to know, for 7 years, FBI agent so-and-so had his hands on my throat. Everything you filed had to go to him.
Wow.
And he went behind the scenes and got to the judges.
Jesus.
FBI agent. Because his buddy told him, if this guy gets out, he's going to kill him. Yeah. He retired. The week that he retired was the week I got out.
Wow. That's when he retired.
It was all insane. I'm saying to myself, I can understand. I got two buddies of mine just got out this week, Monday. Joey Testa. I think Anthony's already out. They have Gemini twins. You ever hear their case?
I did.
Well, I don't know if they did it, but there's an extreme amount of violence in them. Like I said, they're my friends. I don't know if they did any violence.
Right.
But my case compared to them, They just did 35 apiece. But they had other priors.
Right. You had nothing.
Nothing. So nothing. This is very important, ladies and gentlemen. How does the average prisoner, and it's not only his average prisoners, he could be a good guy, he could be a father, he got caught up, but how does he get out? I mean, I use my brain like it's never been done, used before in prison. How do these poor souls get out? How do these minorities get out? They don't. They don't. And that's the sad part. That's the sad part. When I first came home, I did an awful lot of prison advocacy work. I was doing too much. And my daughter, who's like, she's like my conscience, she said, Dad, it's enough. It's enough. You're going to devote your life. You got to have a life.
Mm-hmm.
So I backed up from that. I still do work, prison advocate work, but not as much, not as much. But I won't get involved with any prisoner, he or she. Incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, prisoner's not a guy thing. There's women suffering just as much. You have to understand that. So before I get involved in helping a he or she prisoner, I ask for their progress report. I said that early in the show. Every 6 months, you get a progress report. And it tells you what you've been doing. So how can I help you if I don't know what you've been doing? And I still do some advocate work. Hopefully, with the next administration, they're going to change these minimum mandatories. This previous administration has done nothing. 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 So, you know, 85% of the time, it's insane. It's insane. Now, it's on social media. They can't even get guards anymore to work in these places.
Yeah.
There's a big shortage.
Sure.
So,
Working for those groups. Your daughter told you to pull it back a little bit, which you did.
Yeah, she says, when are you going to have your own?
Sure. Tell people what you're doing now, George. So what are you involved in now? You got the new Netflix thing coming up.
32 plus years
right.
for weed. And that, you, ladies and gentlemen, go to growfather.com. And I have my own factory and distributorship in the state of New Jersey. Matter of fact, every dispensary has ordered my product. And they only ordered if I come and give a speech.
Right.
When I'm back east, I talk 2-3 times a day all over the state of Jersey.
Wow.
So I'm very proud of that because by opening up, I got 12 people working. So I had 12 young people that have jobs. I started my own beer brewery called the Growfather Beer. And also I have, you can see it at berlinbreweries.com, berlinbreweries.com. I even have a beer called Mugshot. It's my prison mugshot. My real prison mugshot.
Wow.
And I'm proud of that. I have employees there. And I just started a medical site called Tower Meds, ttowermeds.com. I'm very proud that I'm creating jobs.
And a new Netflix show coming out?
Yeah, I gave a verbal commitment that I would do the show. Contracts will probably come. It's going to be Netflix, three-hour shows on the Philly mob, which has never really been extensively done in the right light. So we're going to be doing that. Work very hard. Probably going to be shooting for 6 weeks in Philly. And then hopefully, which I've been trying to get a scripted series of my personal life. We're going to call it The Growfather.
I love that name, and I love that logo when you gave me your card. It's incredible.
I want to put one thing in. We'll probably put it in at the beginning of the show. I think it's better in the beginning because John doesn't know this part yet. Can you talk about this? So you tell him your experiences with Pablo Escobar.
Pablo.
You had personal experiences with him, am I correct? Everyone thinks Pablo was back and forth to Miami.
No.
You said absolutely not.
No. He might have sent somebody that looked like him.
Right.
And they thought it was Pablo, but Pablo only came one time, and he was back the next day. He was scared to death. But he might have sent guys up here that looked like him.
Tell John and our audience about your time with the money with the
Well, Pablo, Netflix just did a hit series with Griselda Blanco.
Yes, Griselda.
Very, very close with her.
Personally knew her, too?
Oh, yeah. The woman that played her did a great job.
Beautiful Colombian actress. I can't think of her name.
Did a great
job,
but Griselda was much shorter. She was very pretty when she was young. She had a bad life. They had her on the streets when she was 12 years old, poor. You know, she had a bad life. But her and Pablo basically grew up together. I got involved with them when they were doing marijuana.
This is before the cocaine.
Yeah. And then they told me they're not doing the marijuana anymore. And I said, I'm not doing cocaine. I got away from them. And from there, I went to Jamaica. I started growing my own in Jamaica. But Pablo, he was a character. I was bad. I wasn't hurting people, but I always come up with some schemes, and I used to owe him money, serious money, and I used to stick counterfeit money in there. You know, maybe
giving
80,
Pablo
90
Escobar
grand.
Counterfeit
I
money.
I used to get counterfeit money, so I got away with it two times. The third time, back then it was pagers, so Giselda paged me, and I went over. Him and her had five houses in Kendall, Florida. Had five houses, might have had $200-300 million in one, cocaine in the other, you know. And he's on the phone. He said, Georgie, Opalaka, tomorrow, you come. I got to see you. I said, all right. Opalaka's an airport. and we fly down, taking cash too. We fly down. We flew into Medellin. His ranch was between Paella and Medellin. And we go to the ranch. And he's always doing something around the ranch. Actually had a, behind the stable, they had a wall where they used to just pitch you up there and shoot you. And he says, Georgie, the funny money. He couldn't say counterfeit money. The funny money. I said, what funny money? You know the funny money. The bank guy calls me about the funny money. It make me look stupid. That's my bank.
But like he owned the bank?
Yeah, he owned the bank. So I said, all right, when I get back, you got to hope you're getting back. When
oh my
I get
God,
back,
you,
I'm
going to
find out that guy, and I'm going to take care of him. He just liked to be hang out with him, you know? He guess what? He used to love to hear mob stories, too.
Really?
And Giselda, too.
But Griselda was that high up. So these shows didn't build her up. She really was legit.
The money. She made, God knows, billions. Anyway.
Oh, my God. And they killed her. You know that Griselda.
Yeah,
they killed,
She invented the drive-by motorcycle shooting. She invented that. That's how they killed her.
So the respect for a female mobster, all these guys worked for her. They were that afraid of her.
She killed literally over close to 200. Eddie, you bought from her. When she got mad, when she dealt with Spanish people, if you know her personally, her eyes would go black.
Black eyes.
But guys like us, she couldn't do enough for. She knew she paid for everything, your vacations and a plane. You don't pay for nothing. She treated you like a king. But with the Spanish, she go black.
And, wow.
And so
you've been in her presence before. You've met her multiple times.
She used to
times.
Cook for me. She'd stand behind me, rub my shoulders. I love you. You're going to be my husband.
Oh, she and killed all her husbands.
Three. That I know
she
of.
She killed her husbands. Georgie, you got to be number
I
four.
I love you. And he calls again. Pays. Tell him. So I get him on the phone. I said, what? He says, she's sending me crazy. I can't stand. Talks about you. You got to marry her.
Oh,
I
my
give you
God.
1,000 keys gift. Kilo. And I could have flipped it for 30, 32 million. I said, I don't do that. I ain't Bob. You know what happens to all their husbands?
Wow.
I don't know about that. Crazy business, he says.
And, so Pablo respected her.
She never made that much money because every drug dealer of any substantial drug land in South Florida, New York, Spanish, you had to buy from, New York is a big market, you know. You had to buy from her. She
Unbelievable.
She killed you.
Unbelievable.
She killed you. She got a kid. I met him in jail. Miami-Dade Mall had just opened up. The most exclusive mall ever in South Florida. She sent this kid to kill these guys. They're at a restaurant. Fancy restaurant. The kid can't speak English, right? He didn't know, really. She should have sat him down. I don't know what she did. Kid was 19. He went in the restaurant, killed 4 or 5 people. They weren't even the right people. It wasn't even the right restaurant.
Oh, my God.
Killed them all. Blah, 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 blah. That's how she was.
Wow, she was powerful.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, yeah. George, this has been great. We really appreciate having you on and coming in here. And, you know, we let you do the talking because you have the stories. You have
it's
great stories. Yeah, and by the way, we could have went an hour and 20 minutes. We could have went another hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah. Reason I'm talking so long.
No, we love you talking.
I like the whole situation. Yeah. It's a great, great setting, great people.
It is.
But what I want to relay to America, please, you young people, follow my example in a good way, like being a writer, an actor, a businessman. Do not follow my example of being on the streets, because I'm going to give you one sentence. The streets don't love you back.
Mm.
Streets don't love you back. And one of my students, I said that to him. When he left prison, he said, could I use that sentence? I said, yes, you can. And he's got a big organization now in Arizona. You can check it out, the streetsdontloveyouback.org.
Wow.
So
nice.
Just want to share.
Well, great.
That
thank
everybody.
You, George.
Great show.
Thank you.
And we can have
on,
you in again. You're
I'll
in Vegas
again.
All the time, right?
Well, I try to stay. I come to Vegas 4 times a year. I stay a month. I love it out here. If you like, there's very good people, variety of good people, great restaurants. At sports events, but
aren't the restaurants great out here?
I don't advise you to gamble.
Right, right. You never really gambled, huh, George?
Never gambled.
Wow.
Me and my father and my godfather, Ange, we never gambled. We'll take your bet. We'll take your bet.
Your dad being an Italian from Philly and Angelo Bruno, these guys never gambled?
Never gambled.
Wow.
Never gambled.
No, wow.
You know, biggest bookmakers was one of the biggest, Salvi Testa. He was a friend of mine. Joe Pons, these were great, good-looking gangsters. I mean, handsome men. And they used to handle all the football. And, some days they couldn't, they took so much. They go find a guy who takes, it's called Edge. You take the Edge work. And I used to take you to, can you take $200,000?
Lay it off.
And I used to make sure Monday they couldn't find me.
Wow. Wow.
Because if you lose,
sure.
you got to pay Tuesday.
Sure, sure.
I just didn't like it. I seen wow. gambling destroy too many lives. I seen
sure.
drugs destroy.
We talk about that all the time on the show, how yeah. gambling destroys so many lives, especially now. The way they do it now, all these companies are legal, and they glamorize it and make it like it's a fun thing, and next thing you know, it's closet gambling.
My daughter, I love Francesca. You can see her on Facebook, Francesca Martirano. Beautiful, beautiful girl. I get a kick out of her friends. My house is a big house, and I have my own apartment. And what goes up, that's where I stay. And above the house is her and her friends. And I catch them. They're making bets.
Of course.
They're going, they bet 200.
Still.
On that phone.
You bet 20s, yeah.
On that phone. But anyway, thanks again.
Well, great.
For
thank you.
Here.
Yeah.
And we'd love to have you again.
Absolutely. Next time I'm back in town.
Excellent. All right, guys. We'll see you guys next week. Glad that we had George on here. And, hope you guys tune in, like, and subscribe. Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.